Why does every recipe I try need 18 ingredients, including a jar of something paste I'll never use again but will sit in my fridge for 9 months? I just want dinner in the oven, fast. That's why I love Blue Apron's new one-pan assemble and bake meals. They send you fresh ingredients that are already chopped. All you do is put it all together and bake. That's it. No chopping, no weird leftovers, just delicious, easy-to-make meals. Get 20% off your first two orders with code APRON20. Terms and conditions apply. Visit blueapron.com/terms for more.
Hi, this is Javon, your Blinds.com design consultant.
Oh, wow, a real person.
Yep, I'm here to help with everything from selecting the perfect window treatments to...
Well, I've got a complicated project.
No problem. We make the complex simple. I can even help schedule a professional measure and install.
I didn't realize you did that.
We can also send you samples fast and free.
Wow, I always thought I needed a designer to come to my home, but scheduling's always a nightmare.
Not with Blinds.com. We're on your schedule, and there's no haggling, pressure, or hidden fees either.
I just might have to do more.
Whatever you need. How about you tell me what you had in mind?
Okay, then. So the first room we're looking at is for guests coming over, and I'm thinking of something.
From free expert design help to our 100% satisfaction guarantee, everything we do is made to fit your life and your windows. Because at Blinds.com, the only thing we treat better than windows is you. Visit Blinds.com now for up to 50% off primetime deals and free professional installation. Rules and restrictions apply.
I need a job with a steady paycheck.
I need a job that offers health care on day one for me and my kids.
I want a job where I can get certified in technical roles, like robotics or software engineering.
In communities across the country, hourly Amazon employees earn an average of over $23 an hour, with opportunities to grow their skills and their paycheck by enrolling in free skills training programs and apprenticeships. Learn more at aboutamazon.com.
Back in on the Gabe Kuhn Show, 92.9 FM, ESPN, and joining me, as he always does Tuesday at this time, that would be Christian Fowler at CFowlerBCM on X, a senior writer and content creator for Bluff City Media. And we have a podcast, releases every single Tuesday at 10 a.m. It's called the On the Bluff Podcast. Make sure you go check it out at the Bluff City Media Podcast Network. Christian, how we doing, brother?
I'm doing great. It's bachelor trip this weekend, so I'm excited. Every day is a little bit brighter this week because I know what's at the end of the tunnel.
Okay, so where are you going? What are the plans?
We are going to Crossville, Tennessee, which is like an hour and a half east of Nashville, and it's a full-blown golf trip. There's a bunch of golf courses, so we're going to stop in Nashville or right outside of Nashville on the first day, play Gaylord Springs, and then we got a few other courses lined up over the next few days.
See, and golf is new to you, though. Like, this is like the past year and a half you really picked up the clubs and started going, and now you have the itch. I love to see it.
Absolutely. And it's not like I'm terrible. Like, I'm not.
Of course. I mean, listen, weekend golfers are not good.
Yeah, no, I'm terrible. But to me, and you know me well enough to know, like, I'm with people all the time. We have a huge friend group, so we're always together. And so golf is, like, another one of those things. Just like watching football on Saturday or Sundays, like, golf's another one of those things where it's just, like, everybody's hanging out, everybody's together. You get to laugh at each other, pick on each other, and, yeah, you know, you might hit one good
shot. Yeah, and you hit those one or two good shots that bring you back. I mean, it's all good. I hear you.
Yeah, so – It's gonna be a good time. I'm excited.
All right, now Tigers seems to be that they're having a good time. 5-0, went over Florida Atlantic 55-26. We talked about it on the podcast, and I know it sounds insane, but it was a relatively close 55-26 game. They scored 31 points in that final quarter, in that fourth quarter. They ran the ball well. Brendan Lewis played a pretty clean game, but it was 17-16 at halftime. It was. Like I said, a relatively close 55-26 game, but 5-0, five covers. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, the fourth quarter, extremely impressive. They blew Florida Atlantic out in the fourth quarter, but for the most of the game, it was kept close. It was pretty tightly contested. I never personally watching it felt too worried that Memphis was going to blow this game or find a way to lose the game. It felt like they had control for the majority of it. Especially when you can run the ball like they can, then you're pretty good at controlling games. And I felt like this was similar to the majority of the season so far. You kind of work your way through the first half and go, okay, we missed some things. It was okay on both sides of the ball, but not perfect. And then the second half, because of the way that they run the ball and because of their, I guess, just their desire to sell out to run the ball, like, they're not going to abandon the run. It is the identity of this team is running the football, so they're not going to get away from it. And they just stay persistent and they stay at it. And eventually the dam breaks and the opposing defense wears down enough to where Memphis imposes their will and does what they want to do. And that's exactly what we saw in this game. And when you look at the stats from this year, when you run the ball 40-plus times every game, when you run for 200-plus yards in every game, it is only a matter of time until a defensive line is just totally gassed out. If you're having any success at all on the ground, eventually things are going to open up, guys are going to get tired, you're going to get the right defensive line rotation that you can win against, and you're going to break big runs. And that's what we saw once again in this game. And defensively, the pass defense wasn't all that impressive once again. Velcamp threw for over 300 yards in this game. But run defense, once again, was really good. And that's just kind of the way this team is built. Look, like, bend but don't break, play well against the run. Run against other teams. Like,
yes.
They
know who they are. That's one thing I will give them credit for. They're the seventh-ranked rushing offense. They stop the run, so they're good on both lines of scrimmage. But, like, when we talk about, like, the sort of negatives of who they are, definitely a second-half team, and I don't know how sustainable that is. You got to be careful with that. You don't want to get yourself into too big of a hole in the first half like they did against Arkansas on a consistent basis, and you don't want to be clinging on to one-point leads against inferior competition, letting them stay around, especially at their place. And then, you know, the secondary, they're going to give up yards, but hopefully they can be opportunistic. Like, I will say, it seems like every FBS game they've played this year has played out just about the same.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. But really, to me, like, one of the big takeaways of this game, and who knows how much you can actually glean from a win over FAU, but the biggest thing, we talked about this last week after the win over Arkansas, you are now pretty much in a cycle outside of South Florida, Tulane, and Navy. You're in a cycle of line them up and knock them down.
Yep.
Don't get distracted. Don't look forward to the next week. Just handle the task at hand. And on the road against a bad Florida Atlantic team, that's exactly what they did. And I think that's a good sign for the rest of these games. Even though you want a little more distance in the first half, I think this continues to show us this isn't the same Memphis team. And I know they scored a ton of points. I think it was, 31 points in the
fourth quarter
or something like that. But Memphis is not accustomed to blowing teams out, even inferior opponents in the Ryan Silverfield era. And that's just, for the most part, because when they get a lead, they tend to sit on it and play pretty conservatively offensively. And they're not deviating from that too much this year. They're just so much more successful at running the ball that in the fourth quarter, late in the third quarter, they're just able to run teams over. And I think that's a great sign for these games against inferior opponents coming up, you know, whether they be at home or on the road. They're not going to be, you know, loud, crazy environments. They're going to be snoozers for the most part. You're playing really bad teams and probably not hyped crowds, especially on the road. So I think this at least let us know, hey, Memphis is capable of blowing these bad teams out. It might take them a little longer just because of their style of play. But it's not like this was a one-score win where you were sweating it out to the end. You pretty much coasted the fourth quarter and took care of business.
Now something we talked about on the pod that I want to bring to air is we did give a shout-out to Tim Kramsey. Because, listen, we can sit here and say it's obvious how he should have run this offense going into this year, you know, moving from Seth Hennigan to Brendan Lewis, completely different skill sets. We sort of had the opinion going into this season that it was going to have to change. But to change it and then ultimately be a top 25 team in points, to be top 10 in rushing yards per game, like that's impressive in itself. We knew it had to change, but it has changed, and they're keeping up the level of production that they had under Seth Hennigan the past 2 years.
Yeah, I think it's a bigger task than people understand or recognize or have given Tim Kramsey credit for. You think about what this team did with Seth Hennigan at quarterback and more pro style offense, play action, under center a decent amount at times. Like, it's just a completely different system. And so in just a matter of months to go from what the offense was like under Seth Hennigan to moving to that, you know, quarterback run, read option, run the ball 40-plus times in every single game, like, that's a massive undertaking, especially when you consider the fact that two returning starters on the offense?
And right, both offensive linemen. Yeah.
Yeah. So not only are you bringing in an entire new offense, but you're bringing in an entire new cast of characters to run that offense. And, you know, maybe some of them played in that offense at previous stops, but still, you know, being in a position to mold all that together in only a matter of months and to have it look like it has from the beginning of the season, that there should be so much credit given to Ryan and Tim Kramsey and this offensive staff for being able to pull that off, because that is no small feat whatsoever. And the thing that we questioned throughout the offseason, we talked about so many times over the summer and into fall camp, is how fast can they really start when they – bring in a new quarterback, an entirely different offense.
And hell, your best wide receiver's been on campus for 2 months, Cortez Bram.
Yeah, it's an entirely new offense, not only schematically, but also just personnel-wise. And we were worried about slow start and how do they handle these early season games. Are they going to give an early season dud? And they haven't. They haven't done that by any means. They've looked really sharp. I mean, you've had some missed opportunities in the passing game, and you've had little things that every team has, but for the most part, it has looked like a well-oiled machine and a team that's been together for multiple years with a quarterback who's been there for multiple years running this system. So it hasn't been talked about a ton, especially not enough in my opinion, but what Tim Kramsey and Silverfield and this offensive staff have been able to piece together and the product that's been put on the field from it, like it is very impressive that in that amount of time they put together one of what's looked like one of the best offenses overall in the country.
Now, we are used to running back talent here at the University of Memphis, dating back to D'Angelo Williams, and then obviously that run from 2016 to 2019, Darrell Henderson Jr., Patrick Taylor, Kenny Gainwell, Antonio Gibson, Tony Pollard. But now you have two guys in that backfield, Greg DeRosier Jr. and Sutton Smith, who it's almost like game to game, it feels like they're going to take turns. In this game, Greg DeRosier had 19 carries, 204 yards, 3 touchdowns with that long of 90. The long of 90 is the first time they've had a 90-yard touchdown run since 1966. But Sutton Smith, of course, was the hero of the Arkansas game. I guess I'll just ask you it this way. Have they done it again in the running back room with these two guys?
Yeah, I mean, they absolutely have, because we've seen just let's take these last 2 weeks and look at it. Sutton Smith goes for, what was it, 150 yards, 160 yards?
It was 147 thereabouts, about 150.
So we'll call it 150 yards, and 65 of those yards came in one of the bigger moments in that Arkansas game. And then you flip to this week, Greg DeRosier goes over 200 with a 90-yard touchdown run. And it just shows you how good this backfield is with those two guys. But it is not similar, really, to the Darrell Henderson, Patrick Taylor, Tony Pollard, Antonio Gibson, Kenneth Gaines. It's not the same as that era, right? Because, I mean, when it was Darrell and Patrick, let's use them as right, the example here. Darrell Henderson was one cut and go straight down the field. Like, he was a one cut runner, yes, to a T. And Patrick Taylor was the bigger back, was brought in for goal line, short yardage, also was good at other things. I don't want to diminish what Patrick Taylor did, but you knew third and one, like, here comes 230 pound, whatever he was, Patrick Taylor. And there's not many guys at the college level that can stop that. With Greg and Sutton, they are very similar players, right? They're smaller backs, shiftier, both really good at catching the ball out of the backfield. So it's hard to use them to complement each other. And we've seen that in the last two games, right? In the Arkansas game, Sutton ran wild. In the FAU game, Greg ran wild. And Sutton didn't really do much in this game, even coming off of that massive performance against Arkansas. So I think from here, it becomes how do you use them both? Because Greg was hurt early in the season, so it was, you know, Sutton and Frank Pizant was a good change of pace with his size, and Makari Bodyford as well. But now with these two guys, it's like, how do we use them in tandem and not just roll with the hot hand? And not that it hasn't worked, because it's looked great in the last two games, but with the lack of receiving threats that you have outside of Cortez Braham, how do we get these guys that are both really good pass-catching backs involved? Is that putting them on the field together in the backfield? Is it putting one in the backfield and one maybe in the slot or in an offset formation? How do you maximize both of their skill sets? Because, yeah, hot hand is great. When you got a guy running for 150-plus yards, that's wonderful. But I just feel like they're too talented. They're both home run hitters. Like, they're both able to score from anywhere on the field. So now it becomes another, you know, we just talked about Tim Kramsey and what he's done with his offense. Now it's like another task for him. How do we get both of them involved and not neglect one of them just because the other is having a great game? And that's a good problem to have, right? Like, having two great running backs it's not the same adage as having two good quarterbacks. Having two running backs is a great thing. So now I think it's just weaving them both in, using their strengths in the passing game and outside the tackles running game, and just making this offense even more dynamic, having both of those guys on the field and saying, is it going to be Greg or is it going to be Sutton? And then you just really put a defense in a bind there.
All right, now any ideas of how to implement both of them? You know what I mean? Because this I think you hit the nail on the head when you say they seem to just be rolling with the hot hand. Greg was the hot hand in that Florida Atlantic game. And then in the Arkansas game, it was Sutton Smith. So the carries get distributed accordingly. But do you have any ideas on how to get them involved both at the same time? I mean, I have one idea, but it's just one formation. I remember back in the day, Antonio Gibson, Kenny Gainwell in 2019, whether it was against SMU or Cincinnati in the conference championship game, you would get that split back, two back personnel out there on the field pretty consistently. Mike Norvell used that to his advantage, and it worked. So maybe there's something like that up Tim Kramsey and Ryan Silverfield's sleeve. But do you have any ideas on how to get those guys involved at the same time?
Yeah, I mean, talking about that split backfield, it's not used very often, and probably just because it's difficult to.
I don't think everybody has the personnel to run it. You know what I mean?
That's what I was going to say. It's difficult to have the personnel to run it, to find two guys that can be on the field at the same time and complement each other. But when you look at a split backfield and what this offense is already doing with the zone reads and stuff like that, if you have a zone read with, well, just use Sutton for an example. You run a zone read with Sutton with Greg next to Brendan Lewis, and then you have options, right? It's a zone read RPO where you can pull it and throw the screen to Greg DeRozier. Like, there's just so many different variations you can run with that. It's almost like the modern version of a triple option,
yes.
I guess. Because you have the reads and you have the screens and the RPOs, and that can be done in a split backfield. That can be done with one of those guys in the slot just pulling offensive linemen out and throwing them a screen, or, you know, having an RPO screen with one of them in the slot. Like, I think there's a lot of different things you can do. Now, can you line one of them up and have them run 20 to 30 routes a game? No, that's not the suggestion. The suggestion is you have a play with both of those guys on the field, and the ball is designed to go to one of those two guys or for Brendan Lewis to run it, whether one of them's in the slot or they're both in the backfield. You can have so much eye candy with that. Start in a split backfield, motion one of them out to the slot, start with one of them in the slot, motion them into the backfield. Like, there's so many different things that you can do to really put a defense in a complete pretzel and not know which one to go with. Is it going to Greg? Is it going to Sutton? Is it a run? Is it a pass? Is Brendan going to keep it and use his legs? I think there's just so much unexplored territory with those three guys on the field at the same time. And I think it's coming. Like I said, we can't forget the injury to Greg earlier in the year that prohibited any of that from happening. And now with both of them breaking out, Silverfield, Kramsey, they're too good of coaches. They're too smart not to find a way to get both of them involved.
All right, Christian. Now we're through 5 weeks of the college football season, and I know you have a bit of a a soapbox moment you have to have today on the show in regards to college football's officiating. Listen, this is a soapbox moment I agree with completely.
Yeah, I don't like doing this, to be honest with you. Like, you hear it in the media all the time, clamoring about officials and bad calls. And, I mean, you and I have done shows together long enough and know each other and thoughts on sports enough to know neither one of us is the guy that every week is clamoring about bad calls and bad officiating, because I genuinely believe it is an incredibly hard job. Like, the things that you have to see in real time, and we can all watch on the TV and say he missed that call. But when you're down there on the field, I don't know how many people have been down on a field during a game. It's not the most easy thing to see, and it's happening extremely fast. So I don't like criticizing officials. It's something that I really stray away from, and I think it just has become kind of trendy and clickbaity these days. But I look at Saturday, and everybody circled that Saturday on the calendar as one of the biggest of the college football season, and the marquee matchups of Georgia and Alabama and LSU and Ole Miss, and Oregon, Penn State, and Tennessee. Mississippi State also like a sneaky good game. And just to pull a couple of them, and I think the worst, without a shadow of a doubt, is the no-targeting call.
Yes.
Late in the game, Oregon and Penn State. If you haven't seen it yet, take a second, and you're probably driving, so stop on the side of the road and look this one up, just so you're there with me if you haven't seen it. The running back gets wrapped up. Both arms are wrapped up. He's going to the ground. Knee is on the ground. I think it was either a linebacker or a safety comes up and hits the Oregon running back with the crown of his helmet.
Head down directly in the face.
Directly in the face. It is the most.
And it bent his back backwards. It was a dangerous play, truthfully.
Yeah. To me, it was the most open and shut targeting call you can have. I mean, it was intent. It was obvious. It was launching. It was crown of the helmet. Every point that they try to make to us every week when we see these reviews on targeting is exactly what this was. And if it didn't go to review, it'd be one thing. It would still be egregious because I think it was blatantly obvious. But it goes to review, and I'm sitting there thinking, okay, absolutely, without a shadow of a doubt, this is going to be an automatic first down for Oregon. I think they would have been inside the five at this point in time. And they say no targeting. And I don't understand. Like, there has to be some kind of explanation for that. And I'm not saying you fire somebody. I'm not going to be one of those guys. But sometimes you have to be held accountable and have an explanation for what happened, because I just don't see how you miss a call like that.
And then, rewinding to last week, Auburn, Oklahoma, right? The SEC officials had no idea about the rules about hiding a wide receiver that ultimately got Oklahoma a free touchdown.
Right.
And then also with that targeting, fast forward back to week five, I was watching the Alabama and Georgia game, and Georgia handled just a little normal inside zone power. I forget what scheme it was, but running back runs it right up the middle, gets stuffed. Here comes a linebacker to try to gang tackle. Makes a little bit of contact with his head, but they called a upright runner a defenseless player. They went to review after calling a targeting and held up the targeting.
Yeah.
And I think the consistency is the issue. Yeah. I have. There's none.
That's exactly how I feel about it. If you're going to call something, if you're going to have rules, be consistent. And, of course, there's going to be mistakes and there's going to be human error. That's just part of it. But there has to be some level of consistency in what exactly are we looking for on these calls. And then also I want to bring up the Tennessee and Mississippi State game, because it was a huge moment in the game. I think it was a 70-plus yard touchdown from Joey Aguilar to Chris Brazel. It was a great play. It was a momentum swinger. And so it happened down the right sideline, and there's an official right on it. He doesn't throw a flag. An official 20 or 30 yards back behind the play throws the flag, which if you watch the play, he couldn't even really see it because Chris Brazel was covering up the defensive back. He put his hands on him, no extension, no push. The DB got turned around, fell down, and the official behind the play throws a flag for offense pass interference. So not only does a touchdown not count, but it's also 15 yards in the wrong direction for Tennessee. I think it made it first and 25 after that. And it's just plays like that that completely changed the game and could have changed the outcome of the game, that it is mind-numbing and aggravating to watch. Now, fortunately, Bama wins that game despite a bad call. Oregon wins that game despite a bad call.
Tennessee wins
that game, right, despite a bad call. Or I think it would be even more of a topic of conversation this week. But I just and I understand there's a ton of officials at the collegiate level. You have all these conferences, all these teams, all these games that have to be officiated. But when we get marquee matchups between Big Ten teams or SEC teams, like, we got to have the best out there. The guys that, you know, have a very small percentage of errors and typically make the right calls and are consistent in their calls. Yeah. We cannot have games come down or even big moments in games come down to just poor officiating. So I hate to be the guy that has that conversation after the weekend, but it was very much on my nerves.
If one of those teams had lost this past week, and it would suck to be, college football playoff committee time, they're seeing who's in and who's out, one of those teams is left out, and you in your head are questioning, well, what if they would have called that one play correctly? Would this team be left out? Probably not. Like And I think just generally with big matchups, whether it's NFL or college football, I hate coming out of the weekend and having to talk about officiating as opposed to what happened on the field, right?
Yeah, I could not agree more. And I gave the NFL props on the podcast last night, and I really, like, truly believe the NFL officiating is at a different level. Now, obviously, it's a lot less games, a lot less teams. I'm sure it's more money to be an NFL referee. But with replay assist and virtual measurement and all of these steps that the NFL is taking to improve the officiating, I think we're seeing it. Now, of course, there's always going, like I said earlier, there's always going to be human error. There's always going to be missed calls. But the NFL, you watch on Sunday and Thursday and Monday, you watch all these games like we do, and there aren't too many calls. We don't hear a lot of talk about refs anymore in the NFL. It used to be a hot-button issue every week. Every Monday, you'd hear ESPN, you'd hear everybody talking about officiating. That doesn't really happen much in the NFL anymore, but college, they got to figure something out. It's got to be better. It's got to be more consistent. It just has to make sense, honestly, at the end of the day.
All right, I have one more thing for you, and truthfully, it has to do with Week 5 and Alabama. They go on the road and beat Georgia. Right, but they lost Florida State to start the year. Florida State loses to Virginia. Maybe Florida State's not what we once thought they were. But Alabama got a good win. I mean, I'll give them credit. Ty Simpson, he showed that the last couple of weeks against Wisconsin, UL Monroe weren't flukes. But Bama didn't score in the second half. They have that loss to Florida State. We know that just generally, Alabama's a thorn in the side of Kirby Smart. He's now 1-7 against them since he took over as a Georgia head coach. My question really is, what do I do with Bama for the rest of the year? Because I feel very similarly, to the way I felt last year when they beat Georgia. You feel like they're back. You feel like they're going to absolutely roll. But we know how last year ended up as well, even with that win over Georgia.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very interesting conversation to have right now for the reasons that you said. I mean, this is a carbon copy of what we saw last year. We weren't impressed all that much with Alabama, and then they go just the college football game of the year last year, the shootout with Georgia. It's going back and forth. Alabama takes the early lead. Georgia battles back. Ryan Williams has some incredible plays throughout the game. Like, it was the best college football game of the season last year. And a lot of people were ready to crown Alabama, to crown Kalen DeBoer, to crown Jalen Milroe, and then it just kind of fell apart down the stretch for Alabama. So I think they're a good football team, but I do not think that they are without flaws, right. Much like last year. I mean, even after that win against Georgia, you said, okay, they beat Georgia, but their defense got shredded. They didn't look great in a lot of areas. And this year – it feels very similar because we still don't fully know what we have in Ty Simpson. I mean, right now he's second in Heisman odds. He's had a really good year. I think he's better than Jalen Milroe, especially as a thrower of the ball. And he looks like he's very confident and comfortable. He knows when to take off. He can make all the throws. Like I am extremely impressed with Ty Simpson. I don't think he's been talked about enough over the last few weeks. But Alabama cannot stop the run, which is just alarming, right? Like, we've never see Alabama struggle against the run, but Georgia had their way on the ground. They ran all over Alabama in this game. And so, to me, it's kind of the same with every team in the SEC, right? My feelings about the top half of the SEC are all pretty much the same. There's a lot of really good teams, but there has not one team that has separated themselves from the pack yet and stamped themselves
right
as an elite team in college football. I mean, just go down the list in the SEC. Okay, Georgia just lost to Bama. Bama beat
really
Georgia.
Ole Miss is the closest to sort of doing what you're talking about. But I don't think anybody thinks, you know, down the stretch of the season they're going to lose no games. They have Georgia. They have Oklahoma, both on the road.
Yeah, and let's not forget they were a fumble away from potentially losing
right.
to Arkansas
two weeks ago,
who just got blown out by Notre Dame and fired their coaching staff. Like,
right.
And I think Ole Miss is a good team. I think Bama's a good team. I think Georgia's a good team. I think Texas could still be impressive. Oklahoma with John Mateer. We'll see what happens while he's injured. Tennessee, I still think, is a good football team. Like, there are a lot of really good teams in the SEC, but you can point out a lot of flaws along the way. And
sure.
You look at the Big Ten, and I think the SEC is a lot deeper, but you look at the top two teams in the country now, Ohio State and Oregon, and it's hard to poke a lot of holes in them, especially Ohio State, the way that Matt Patricia has that defense playing.
Right.
The way that Julian Sain is controlling the game, and they still haven't fully unleashed him yet with Jeremiah Smith and Carnell Tate. I just look at those two teams specifically in Oregon and Ohio State, and I go, I don't know if there's anybody in the SEC that is that caliber that I look at and go,
right,
they're going to be almost impossible to beat. I think every team is flawed. I think there are going to be a lot of games where we look up this year and go, wow, that fill-in-the-blank team lost to that team. I can't believe it. But the writing is all on the wall, right?
Yep.
I mean, just like we just talked about, Ole Miss almost losing to Arkansas. Tennessee almost lost to Mississippi State over the weekend. Like, there are Ole Miss also played a close game with Kentucky. And I know this is pre-Trinidad Chambliss with Austin Simmons. But still, you look at the top teams in the SEC, and I think there's going to be a lot of close games this year. I think there's going to be a lot of potential upsets or at least scares from teams in the mid-tier to the bottom tier of the SEC. Same thing, Tennessee and Georgia go to overtime, and Tennessee should win that game. They are going to beat up on each other heavily this year.
Yeah, this is a yearly conversation, though, now, at this point.
Yeah.
And, like, 100%. Just looking at the standings, just for those that want a little bit of an understanding of what we're talking about, at the top of the SEC, the teams that have zero losses on their resume, Ole Miss, Mizzou, Oklahoma, A&M, and Vandy.
Yeah.
Right? And the teams that have losses so far, Alabama, LSU, Tennessee, Georgia, and Texas. You know what I mean? It's just it's a strange reality we're living in. It really is. It's changed so quickly. And I think really, you know, there's a lot of different reasons we could attribute to it. But I think NIL and everybody being able to raise money in that conference, it truly has been a big game changer.
Yeah, I'm interested to see how it shakes out, because you mentioned Vandy. Obviously, they haven't been tested yet, so I'm definitely not ready to say that Vanderbilt is a threat in the SEC. I think they're probably fraudulent. I think Diego Pavi is too limited.
Oh, you calm down. You bite your tongue, brother.
I mean, I like him. I love the story, but we saw the same thing last year, right? They were rolling, and then they started playing good teams, and they
– Well, at least they beat Georgia State this year.
Right? yeah, that's
so,
true.
It's a little different.
Did they lose five or six in a row last year? Like when they hit the meat of the SEC schedule,
they did not fare well.
And A&M, I didn't even bring them up. They're definitely in that upper echelon of the SEC. They clearly still have a lot of games to go. I don't know if you have yet, but look at Oklahoma's schedule. It is
it's
gauntlet.
It is
terrifying what they have to go up against. Like, for them to be able to secure a playoff spot is a nightmare.
And they have John Mateer out for probably the next month.
Yeah, so the SEC, and we've said it forever, right? Like, the SEC beats up on each other, but typically there's a team or two
That's going to go undefeated.
That's going to go undefeated and run the table. And there isn't that this year. I mean, even the undefeated teams that you named, we just talked about Ole Miss and them having close games with Kentucky and Arkansas. So it's hard to see them going undefeated. No way Vandy goes undefeated. Missouri, they haven't really been challenged yet. I'm biased. I can't stand Eli Drinkwitz, so I'm not a fan. I'm not a fan. But Prabula's been good, so maybe they surprise some people. But I don't see any way that a team in the SEC this year makes it out unscathed, especially with the teams that already have a loss. And we can level that to SEC play. I don't know if anybody makes it out of SEC play undefeated. That would be pretty remarkable if they did.
Yep, I hear you. Well, Christian, I'll let you roll, man. We'll catch up again next week.
Yes, sir. See y'all back next week.
Yes, sir. He is Christian Fowler at CFowlerBCM on X. Go follow him. He's a senior writer and content creator for Bluff City Media. And we have a podcast, the On the Bluff podcast, releases every single Tuesday at 10 a.m. Make sure you go check it out. Now it's time to blitz right here on the Gabe Kuhn Show. Stick around for that. 92.9 FM, ESPN.
Now, the biggest stories. Overloading the line. A bull rush of info. It's Gabe's Blitz on the Gabe Kuhn Show on 92.9 FM ESPN, Memphis' sports station.
Oh, man, I'm so excited to be here, Gabe.
Hey, Brad, I'm glad to have you. Yeah. I'm glad to have you.
Connor, a little under the weather. I know we had George in here earlier and jetted out of here. So I thought I'd bring in a story about the St. Louis Cardinals. Of course, they're in their GM transition.
Of course.
Both of us originally from St. Louis. And most of our lives, John Mozeliak has been the general manager or the president of baseball operations currently and now turning it over to Shane Bloom, now assuming the role, headed into the offseason. They both had press conferences. Mozeliak did his yesterday. Bloom did his today. Mozeliak was in that last role for 18 years with the Cardinals. I'll just tee it up for you and see where we go, because I bet we're both pretty passionate about these Cardinals.
So Mozeliak's been there genuinely most of my life.
Yeah.
Walt Jocketty before him, and I thought Walt Jocketty did a really good job. They had a really good scouting department. They made some things happen. Mozeliak took over in a prime era to be a president of baseball ops for the St. Louis Cardinals, because they were spending a bunch of money and they were willing to sign big name players, and all the players wanted to be with the St. Louis Cardinals. But I hate to say it, and I think Mo won, 2011 World Series, 2011 and 2013 NL title winners, but not much after that. Mm-hmm. Just sort of bowing out in the playoffs after a couple of rounds, never really competing at the highest of levels. Obviously, the money started to dry up, so that's part of it. But I hate to put it this way. He gave a lot of good years of service to the Cardinals, but I don't think he did anything exceptional with the Cardinals over 18 years. And I know there's some Cardinals fans that will push back at me and always look at 2011 in that World Series and look at 2013 and look at all the players that he was able to bring in.
Yeah.
Even when the money was drying up, they may have a different opinion. I'm sorry. This is the opinion I have.
So
it's changed drastically. I also saw when he was doing his final presser, he sort of threw some shade at Kyle Bloom coming in. And he said, over my 18 years, we never talked about rebuilding. You may hear about rebuilding as soon as Keim gets. He didn't say Keim.
He didn't say it
by name, but you may hear about rebuilding here soon.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's where you've left this franchise. You get this. This is just an insane stat to me, considering what I grew up watching in the St. Louis Cardinals. They are now 3 years out of playoffs. They have not been to the playoffs in 3 years. Mm-hmm. That's a top 10 number with playoff droughts in Major League Baseball. It's a frustrating reality. And if we're talking about what Kyle Bloom or this organization needs to do going forward to get fans back involved, to get people back engaged, I think there's one answer, and it's very simple. Spend money on good talent.
Mm-hmm.
Put together a good team.
Yeah.
Like, I think they even discussed, I have a three-prong plan. How to get more butts in the seats, how to get these fans more involved. They are some of the most loyal fans in baseball, but they have watched this organization completely crumble from the inside out, and they want answers that they're not getting. So I think the simple answer is spend money, put together a good product, right?
Yeah, I think you and I are on the exact same page, and I thought Walt Jocketty did a good job. Now, I do acknowledge that the game has changed.
Sure.
Right? it is more Moneyball. When we say Moneyball, it's actually less strategy and just spending a lot of money.
Yes, that's what we mean by Moneyball.
Yeah. 15 years ago when they put the movie out, it was more about taking analytics and working around the edges with the low payroll and the A's. Now it's just outspend people.
Yes.
And I don't think you and I are of the mind that they need to be the Dodgers, the Mets.
No.
It would be nice to be towards the top five in payroll.
Having a couple of stars
right,
would be helpful.
Yep.
It just truthfully.
Yeah.
And when I watch a lineup where throughout the season, at times, for 40-game stretches, Alec Burleson is the best batter in the lineup.
Yeah.
A guy who has been, and I love Alec Burleson, but he's been up and down from AAA here in Memphis to St. Louis for how many years at this point? Right. When I watch the first 80 games of the year and Brendan Donovan is basically your all-star. Like, that's not how things should be.
And I also think it can't be come here because we're the Cardinals. And that happened with Arenado. That happened with the trade with Goldschmidt.
That's over, though, now.
There was these, and it's, let's be real about this. Both of those guys, both corner guys, were discount guys, and they were stars. But you got them because this is 10 years ago when there was this era of, I'll come from Arizona because I hear the Cardinals are awesome and I'm a nice guy.
What a great organization, great fans, all those things.
You can piss that out the window now.
It's gone.
It is total. It's like NIL. You'll go to Starkville if you'll take $500,000, and you'll be fine there in the middle of a cornfield. It's fine. You know, same thing with St. Louis. Like, if you pay these dudes, they'll play a corner infield spot for you.
I think this is just with all sports, like, worldwide, quite frankly. We're in a different era
time. Yes.
And athletes don't necessarily sit here and they say, I remember what you did in 1908.
Right.
You guys have this long, great history of being this great organization. They don't care about that. They're saying, how much money can you give me now? What do your facilities look like? What's your manager like? Is your GM nice? Can I have some personal relationships behind the scenes? I think the Cardinals have fallen behind in just about every single possible category when it comes to Major League Baseball.
By the way, Memphis would have players if they outspent everybody. That's also true. if the Grizzlies had were outspending the cap, you would see the salary cap as well. But you, obviously, if you were going two and above and you were paying the tax, you'd see players here. I promise you, Desmond Bain would still be here. So you have to work around the edges. Cardinals probably need to be more in that 5-10 range. I will say on Mozeliak, the truth of the matter is his success even in 11-13 is dated back to a guy named Jeff Luhnow.
Yes, 100%. Thank you for bringing it up.
Jeff Luhnow will forever be the guy behind Mozeliak.
And obviously we know what happened with him.
He went to Houston, and of course he had the cheating stuff. But let me just say, he's awesome.
He is one of the best farm system builders I've ever seen in the history of baseball.
That has bared itself out.
Yes, 100%. The Astros had to fall on the sword for the Astros. Yes. Astros have fallen off drastically.
Now he built it and forget about the banging pans. They were still really good and they had a roster full of dudes. So hoping for the best from Bloom in the new organization here.
Yeah! Also, real quick, do you get a kick out of the fact that I look at all these national reporters on Major League Baseball and since Ali Marmol took over as the manager, he hasn't. I mean, 3 years not making the playoffs.
No.
And every single reporter says, he's untouchable. It's like, I don't think it's his fault directly the way they've played. They don't have good enough talent. But it's kind of insane to me that a guy that is St. Louis Cardinals manager who hasn't been to the playoffs in 3 years is completely safe, just untouchable.
We're very passionate about this. So I'll get this out of the way, too, before we go to the WNBA story, since I hit the blitz sounder. It's not unlike what we're dealing with in Memphis. The exception is in St. Louis, they're not moving Busch Stadium or the Cardinals.
Right.
And in Memphis, we don't have a lease deal.
Yeah, you're
and so
concerned.
There's nervous energy. There's no nervous energy in St. Louis. They just basically are voting with their butts, and they're going to have to figure that out.
Yep,
so
sure.
Looking forward to the Cardinals fixing this, though. Additional takeaways from Nafisa Collier's exit interviews. We had exit interviews in the WNBA, and we've got notes here, but I'll start with your blitz item here. Minnesota Lynx star Nafisa Collier, she used her exit interviews to call out the WNBA's leadership, specifically their commissioner, Kathy Engelbert, and basically threw her under bus. She told her only losers complain about the refs. This is what Collier said Kathy Engelbert told her only losers complain about the refs. And then Collier said that Engelbert, the commissioner, told her that Caitlin Clark should be grateful for the WNBA because the league is responsible for her sponsorship deals. Collier said she tore a couple ligaments in her ankle during Game 3 against Phoenix. We go to battle every day to protect a shield for a league that doesn't value us. She hates the commissioner of the WNBA.
All right. It was about 4 minutes and 30 seconds. And I know not everybody takes in the WNBA. I know some people don't like the
gamblers
league.
Seem to
it
love
is
it.
What it is. But if you take any stock or if you bet on the league, if you care about the league, go watch what Nafisa Collier had to say. She had a prepared statement. She was ready to go. And I agree with every last statement she uttered, quite frankly. Kathy Engelbert has not done anything good for the WNBA. Even the TV contract she is lauding, it's not enough value. You brought in Caitlin Clark and Angel Reese and Paige Beckers and all these, and you're going to have Juju Watkins, who, sorry to hear, she's out for the year.
Yeah.
That stinks for women's college basketball. But you're going to have Juju Watkins soon. You're going to have all the Hannah Hidalgo, all these unbelievable players with these big social media followings that kids are latching on to that are very marketable. And she just sort of took the number that the NBA threw at her. And she's lauding that as like, oh, what a win. You guys should be thankful for the work that I've done. It's insane to me. And like, I saw this from Bobby Marks. He just did some sort of quick napkin math on, you know, what they get for ticket sales and how much money they can actually afford. And he ended up just going to Game 5, where the Lynx lost, got knocked out of the playoffs. But he went to Game 5. They made $850,000 at the door and concessions and everything else for that one night for Game 5 of that series. And do you know what the WNBA's cap is now? $1.5 million.
Oh,
that's one night worth of work. You get $850,000. Yeah. So like, there's this.
It's off.
It's off. It truly is. And Kathy Engelbert is cool just sitting there doing nothing about it. I don't think that this league is generating the amount of value. I don't that it needs to. I don't think this league is taking advantage of the momentum that they have been able to get. Luckily, mind you, from Caitlin Clark and Paige Beckers and Angel Reese. I don't think they've done it. And for her to say, Caitlin Clark should be happy because we give her the platform to where she can get sponsorships. You don't remember her at Iowa?
Yeah.
How much money she was making at Iowa? She was probably one of the highest paid athletes in college sports at that time. So she doesn't need your platform to make all that money. You're just the only platform that's available.
Yeah.
I think she needs to get that through her head. I think Caitlin Clark would be able to get those sponsorships wherever she went. She could go overseas and probably get those sponsorships. But the WNBA, Kathy Engelbert, she wants to take credit for that. That's insane to me.
The only thing I can add to that is that it feels like, not just the numbers you laid out, but it feels like they haven't just, when you have a, this is really the biggest thing that's ever happened to the WNBA and Caitlin Clark. Wouldn't you agree with that? I mean, Caitlin Clark is the number one. She's the Michael Jordan of the NBA version, of WNBA version.
Yes.
And she hasn't taken that and to the next level.
Yeah, the difference between taking it off tape delay and actually watching it, that type of thing. Yeah, like that's the difference she's making, but you haven't actually, that hasn't shown up, in my opinion, in the free market. And that's a frustrating reality of Kathy Engelbert. And also to talk about the officiating, and I'm not too tuned into that, but to say only losers talk about officiating, stop it.
That's just disgraceful to say that to a player.
Nafisa Collier is a freaking MVP caliber player, constantly all WNBA. She's one of the best players you have.
Right.
And I would not call her a loser
because
she's complaining about refereeing. Yeah. If she has a complaint, I'm sure it's probably earned.
Well, and you need your former players to vouch for your league.
No doubt about it. No doubt about it. But that will do it for the Blitz. One more segment left in the day. We'll rewind when we return right here on the Gabe Kuhn Show, 92.9 FM ESPN.
Honestly, I wasn't sure we could pull this off ourselves.
You had the vision, and Blinds.com brought your dreams to life.
Yeah, their custom window treatments and free design consultation. Total game changer. Ava walked us through everything. Styles, colors, what would work best in this space.
And we didn't have to leave the house. Free samples showed up fast, and they made it super easy to compare and choose.
Right? Plus, no high-pressure sales pitch, just smart guidance. And the install? I thought it'd be tricky, but Blinds.com instructions were clear. Everything fits perfectly.
And thanks to their SureFit guarantee, if something doesn't fit, they remake it for free. Talk about peace of mind.
And it costs way less than having a designer to our house or going to one of those overpriced showrooms.
We saved money, got the exact look we wanted, and we did it ourselves.
We did it.
So, kitchen windows next?
Blinds.com makes buying and installing window treatments easy and affordable because nobody covers windows better than Blinds.com. Visit Blinds.com now for up to 50% off primetime deals and free professional installation. Rules and restrictions apply.
I need a job with a steady paycheck.
I need a job that offers health care on day one for me and my kids.
I want a job where I can get certified in technical roles, like robotics or software engineering.
In communities across the country, hourly Amazon employees earn an average of over $23 an hour, with opportunities to grow their skills and their paycheck by enrolling in free skills training programs and apprenticeships. Learn more at aboutamazon.com.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
True North Convenience Stores and Red Bull are an elite matchup. True North offers returning players Red Bull Original and Sugar Free. First round picks like Watermelon, Wild Berries, and the newest rookie, Red Bull Zero. Right now, grab three of your favorite 8-ounce can flavors for $6.50 and save 10 cents off a gallon with the True Rewards mobile app. Available in your favorite app store. Rush into True North to score this deal before the clock runs out. True North Convenience Stores. Fast, friendly, clean.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up, you get early payout on parlays too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.